healthcare reform has been signed into law. It was quite a ride to get to this point, and now seems a good time to lend some ethical perspectives to how we got here and how we should move forward. Joining us now on the Bioethics Channel are a panel of individuals from the Center for Practical Bioethics. Rosemary Flanagan, Distinguished Fellow, John Carney, Vice President for Aging and End of Life, and Terry Roselle, the Rosemary Flanagan Chair at the Center. Let us begin with general thoughts and reactions from our panel about the ethical dimensions that were on display during the debate on health care reform. Rosemary, let's start with you.
Well, let's go back to the concept of health care as a right. Nobody doubts that living in a society, there are items that people cannot flourish as human beings unless they have, unless those means are available to them. Food, clothing, shelter, adequate employment, we're used to those. What we have seen in recent years is the rise of the notion of health care as such a right. And I will profess that that is a right to my dying day, and not an absolute right or not a right in terms of everything, but with food, clothing, and shelter. We don't say that means that you can gain 300 pounds because you have a right to food. So I think we need lots of nuances around the notion of health care as a right, but that's where I want to start.
Terry Roselle.
Well, I'm listening to Rosemary and thinking we have that notion of health care as a right, but it strikes me and many of us that what's developed instead in this society is health care as a corporate commodity. It strikes me as wrong that some people within a society would get rich off of the sufferings of other people, and yet a case can be made that that's exactly what has happened in the development of a healthcare system such as we have it. So I would like to think that we would be shifting now towards healthcare as a communal responsibility, given a right to it by everyone.
John Carney, as Vice President for Aging and End of Life, you've been paying a lot of attention to this over the past year. Had to be a low point when the discussion turned on the phrase death panels.
Yeah, it was. It was very discouraging, I think, at the time, and an issue that felt pretty close to home because of the work that we had done for many, many years at the center, trying to improve advanced care planning and trying to encourage physicians and patients and families to have these discussions. So it was a low point. However, I think it provided us a new perspective in terms of the, I guess if you will, the stamina or the will, the perseverance from the proponents of healthcare reform, that there was still some hope left, and we needed to dig down deeper and find the conviction about which to really pursue the rest of the battle and carry it across the finish line, which I think has happened.
Now, we can talk a little bit about the ethics of the process itself, but I'm reminded, or you were reminded, of what Aristotle had said about ethics and politics. To me, ethics and politics don't belong in the same sentence. But, John, what do you think about the ethics of the process itself?
Well, I think any public policy issue brings in the worlds of ethics, and it really has to do with the obligation of a society that Rosemary talks about, the perspective of economy, in terms of the commoditization that Terry talked about. And in the American the world of America, where capitalism really is the king of all, those two issues, when they intersect, don't always play well together. And I think that's really what we've seen here. The fundamental philosophical differences about whether or not this is an issue of solidarity, of people caring for people, or whether this is a perspective of business should really determine in the free market the way that this ought to play out. And those are fundamental philosophical and political differences that the parties hold in this country. And, you know, the landscape was out there to have the battle, and it certainly got nasty at times.
Nasty and messy, didn't it?
Yeah, and messy. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I think it really you know, really is incumbent upon us to figure out where we go from here in terms of making this a reality for the people that we're trying to serve.
Terry, ethics and politics.
I was watching on C-SPAN Sunday afternoon and evening the process in the House of Representatives, was watching when my 18-year-old son came in the room and watched for a while. He has some aspirations to do education that might lead in the direction of law and politics, but he had never seen this sort of process go on. And so he watched for a while, and I watched his face, and he said with dismay, "Dad, is this real? Does this really happen in the House of Congress?" And I said, "Yes, son, it does." And I was ashamed. Ashamed of my generation, of political leaders, the sloganeering, the claims without warrants, the tit-for-tat, the overt partisanship of this process throughout the debates, and if they were debates, all the way to the end. And I sincerely hope that good comes of it in the end. I sincerely hope that my son's generation of political leaders behave better than my generation.
I was shocked during this whole year that we have been engaged this, and I'm too old to have been shocked by it. But I spent my life in a classroom teaching undergraduates how to argue ethically, and argument is it's the soul of ethics. I mean, we don't always agree, but to engage in civil argument is just one of the, I don't know, greatest manifestations of being human. And this acrimony, this nastiness, this unjustifiable exchange that has been going on in our country from the extremists has been it's been shocking to me.
Well, let's talk for a minute about, but jump before I get to that, John Carney.
Well, I'm surprised that Rosemary says she's shocked when we talk about kind of the unfolding of this additional right, if you will, as she argues that we're kind of coming to grips with in the United States, knowing that she was one of the famous nuns who marched on Selma for the, you know, for civil rights. And here we are talking about the right to health care, and all we're doing is blaming some bad behavior among our leaders in Congress, as opposed to putting our lives on the line, you know, marching with the threats of being trampled to death or whatever that I think, you know, many people faced during the 60s. So I kind of take it in perspective. I think that this has been a long haul for many, many generations now from the presidents who've said we need to do this. It's a first step. It is not the final step. It is the first step. But I am encouraged by the fact that we were able to get here without at least, you know, some claim 40,000 a year die from the fact that they don't have health insurance. But at least we haven't been overtly out in the streets burning buildings and screaming at each other.
Although we did see some very bad behavior in Washington.
Yes, we did.
And some of our African-American Congress people were treated very badly. And it was reminiscent to them, they said,
yes,
of the 1960s.
But I would like to ask our listeners to consider the framework that Terry just proposed at the beginning of this. Maybe it's a time to stop rights language, and maybe it's a time to start talking about social responsibility. Something about the implications of the common good. And if healthcare, as a floor of healthcare, I'm not asking American taxpayers to pay whatever, but I can't see that we can live in a country where with bad health for which you are not responsible, where I can watch such a person fall through a crack and not get something basic to relieve that person's ill health just seems antithetical to the notion of common good.
Amen. Well, let's move on to what our friend Art Kaplan says, that Americans should agree that everyone won't get everything they want
right.
from reform. that lower-income people, according to Dr. Kaplan, should not expect extras. And he said, private hospital room, he said reform should provide a floor beneath which people will not sink. Do you like that idea, Terry?
Why should those who have less expect not to get a private room? Obviously, this legislation isn't going to guarantee a private room for anybody. So Art Kaplan is surely correct. But it begs the question of why poorer people should deserve or expect less in health care. If I would like a private room, do I deserve one because I happen to have better insurance?
Yes, I think that you expect to get one because you can afford it and you can pay for it. And I, who do not have your level, let's say, of insurance, I should be very happy to be in a ward. I see no problem with rationing health care for the elderly, of whom I am among, if other tiers in society also have their expectations lowered. This new reform, and John understands this better than I do, will decrease Medicare. That is all right with me if the decrease is not markedly lower because we are the older ones. But for us to give up something, you do that in a family. You do that in a community. You do it wherever people are gathered together.
John Carney.
Let me clarify one point, and that is that the private insurance piece of Medicare may be affected, but Medicare itself won't be affected. And that does impact a number of seniors. So there are people who will be affected by the fact that the private market aspects of Medicare would be changed. But in some cases, that's only because that private market has been receiving a bonus from the federal government for the last few years. So there's some changes there. I think the issue of back to this the social dimension of this is really about expanding coverage to people who don't have it. And it really, I think, goes to the question that Rosemary raised at the beginning, is it's a notion of this solidarity that we have with everybody. This was not about controlling costs, as everybody knows now, because that's been a stark omission from the reform efforts. But we need to get started on it. But it does bring more people into the pool and eventually should stabilize the increasing costs as we've seen them just continue to escalate without any kind of limit, simply by the fact that more people are going to be angry when those things happen than there are now, because the only ones of us who really complain are the folks of us who have the coverage.
This sounds very close to what our former colleague Dr. John Lantos talked about, and he's written and spoken on it, about a two-tiered healthcare system. And to you, if I hear you right, Rosemary, you're good with that.
I'm okay with two-tiered if there is a basis on which the lower tier is still supported. I do not expect to have all the perks of high society.
I would agree. I think that as long as the second tier, and there are only two, there's not a third that says left out. And that's what we've had, is we've had a three-tiered system. We've had those with, those kind of with and kind of not, and then we've had those without. And what we need to do as a country is to say we're better off, all of us are better off, if there's a system of with and maybe with a lot versus with and maybe not so much, but there's nobody who's going to fall below that line and say you just simply can't be without.
Terry, I'm looking at your face, and it looks like you have been ruminating on this and have something to say. Share with us, my friend.
I'm just wondering if we're anywhere near a two-tiered system. Even a two-tiered system, there are still people who will be left out. Fewer, hopefully, much fewer, but there are still people who will slip through the cracks, if I'm looking at this anywhere near accurately. And whether or not there should be a one-tier system where you can't buy up, I don't think that's a realistic option for our very capitalistic, individualistic society anyway. So, yes, if we can get to a true two-tier system, that would be much improvement, one in which perhaps we're heading in the direction of corporate or communal responsibility rather than a corporate commodity in terms of health care.
So let's think about now about moving forward. There are a lot of debates to come on health care reform, a lot of work to do. What kind of ethical perspective should people view these debates? What should they think about from an ethical point of view as this debate moves forward? Rosemary?
Well, I think, first of all, what we've got to expand our thinking about is that we live in communities with other people for whom we bear some responsibility. And I think until we get out of our intense individualism, the steps forward will be very halting.
John Carney?
I think it has to do with individual responsibility as well as the social responsibility or the communal responsibility. It has to do with the fact that I cannot function well as a member of society unless I know that everybody else in the society also has that same ability to function alongside of me. And that comes with we do that when we pay taxes for police and fire protection. And what we're doing now is saying to people, all right, there's going to be a mandate that says to you that you've got to buy health insurance because health insurance doesn't work unless everybody's in. And people don't like that. People want to be able to say, I want to be able to be without it if I choose to be without it. Well, the problem is we can't afford to be without it. In this day and age, we simply can't. So that individual responsibility says there's going to be a requirement that you opt in. And I think that's really that individual responsibility has to be underscored just as important as the communal responsibility.
Terry, ethical perspectives as we move forward.
Can I tell a short story?
Of course you can.
I am hopeful that we are moving to a society that would fix a problem that is all too common. I got a call here at the Bioethics Center some months ago from a midlife farmer out in western Kansas. He probably was at their public library on the internet Googling, and he came up with the Center for Practical Bioethics, dialed our number. The phone call got shifted to me, and I listened for about 45 minutes. He told me a story about self-employment as a farmer, about having lost insurance, about not being able to afford insurance, a chronic condition that required medications that cost him hundreds of dollars per month, getting behind in his bills to his primary care doctor in that small town, no longer being able to get prescriptions written because he couldn't get in to see his doctor because his bill was too high, and he was in pain and he had suffering that was unameliorated because the system was broken. He couldn't afford to get into a high risk pool, and he couldn't afford to pay his bills. That strikes me as a sort of society that ought to be changed, not the society I want to live in, to have my children grow up in, grandchildren, and other people's kids. I am hopeful that we are improving society for that farmer and for all others who have slipped through the cracks, for our children and grandchildren, for generations to come.
Our thanks to our panel from the Center for Practical Bioethics, Rosemary Flanagan, Distinguished Fellow, John Carney, Vice President for Aging and End of Life, Terry Rozelle, the Rosemary Flanagan Chair at the Center. You can join this discussion by going to our website at practicalbioethics.org, practicalbioethics.org. We have a blog that we will be placing on there with some thoughts from our panel, so feel free to go to our website and join that discussion, practicalbioethics.org. I'm Laurel LeBou. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.